Well, good day, and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm really excited to have our full cast of our regulars on tonight because we need to do another weather episode. It seems like the tropical weather season has caught up with us yet again. And I think it's a perfect example of many things we've talked about with regards to being aware of and concerned about tropical systems of all sizes, ratings, and classifications. And we'll get into that more in a little bit. But first off, we have to kick things over to my wonderful co-host who does such a great job of organizing and coordinating what our episodes are about each week. And so, hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. Well, it's pretty easy in storm season. Just get our two favorite meteorologists and they can run with it. But yes, we are having another disaster weathercast tonight. And Becky can quote some things she's been tweeting that I thought were pretty interesting. We also are lucky to have Kyle and we have Dr. Joe. And we're going to hit up Dr. Joe to talk about the USAR response to Dorian and now with Imelda. So, Kyle, you want to kick this off and say hi?
Oh, sure thing. Hey, everyone. Kyle Nelson, a meteorologist here coming to you live and direct on the Disaster Podcast. And as Sam hinted at, oh, my goodness, the tropics are showing their true colors as we are just passing the historical peak of the Atlantic hurricane season. And the tropics are not disappointing whatsoever. Both the Central and Eastern Pacific still active as well. Thankfully, things over there are fairly tame. However, when we look in the Gulf and the Atlantic basins, that's where things get pretty interesting. So three systems of note. The first, Hurricane Umberto, blowing rooftops off and toppling trees in Bermuda. Thankfully, well, the U.S. East Coast continuing to head off to the north and east. Jerry, now a hurricane, is expected to move north of the Leeward Islands, but will still bring heavy rain, flash flooding, and tropical storm winds. But the main feature of tonight's podcast, as we were talking about here just a little bit before the show started, and quite a lot of incredible facts and figures that Becky's going to share with us tonight, the remnants of Imelda moving onshore and now across eastern Texas and western Louisiana. Becky, you want to take it?
Yeah, so we have quite a few stats pulled up here, and they're pretty staggering in terms of rainfall amounts. So NWS Houston just tweeted this stat at about 6:15 Eastern. So it's about 3 hours from the time that we're recording this podcast. They say the preliminary highest storm total rainfall amount is 43.15 inches in Jefferson County. That's fallen about the last probably 36 hours or so. That does make Imelda the seventh wettest tropical cyclone in the U.S. history, in recorded history, as well as the fourth wettest tropical cyclone to ever impact the state of Texas. To add on to that, Imelda is now unofficially the fifth biggest tropical rainmaker in continental U.S. history, and it has surpassed Allison's highest rainfall totals from 2001. Allison was really the benchmark in Texas up until Harvey and now Imelda. Harvey does still hold the record for number one. Sam is asking, how does that compare to Harvey? So Harvey still holds the record with 58 inches is the highest rainfall total. Then you have Amelia, which was in 1978 with 48 inches. Easy, which was in 1950, and that was 45.2 inches. Claudette in 1979 with 45 inches, and now Imelda, which is actually a little bit higher than what this tweet was from Mike Bettis, since we're now at 43 inches. Another interesting stat, Houston Fire Department tweeted just about a half an hour ago that they have performed 918 water rescues so far today. That is just on September 19th. Houston Fire Department has performed 918 water rescues. And that doesn't actually include the Cajun Navy, which we really got to know during Hurricane Harvey, which was just everyday, ordinary people going out on their boats to try and rescue people. It's really just kind of astounding to see this happening again. Houston floods regularly for a number of different reasons, but to have these these kinds of rainfall amounts, you know, for the second time in 2 years is pretty unbelievable.
Thank God for the Cajun Navy. And if any of you are listening, I would love to talk to you guys and hear about your exploits. But the people that are suffering from this hurricane are very lucky that you're there because you can't get enough help. But there's another resource we want to hear about, Dr. Joe Holly. You were with the heavy rescue unit, so you didn't go out on Dorian, but your USARs did, and they are engaged with Imelda as well, correct?
That's true. Yeah, I spent a week out for Dorian, although we didn't actually engage in a lot of work, thanks to a lucky right turn by that storm. Avoided a whole lot of badness. And yeah, teams are already in the field again for Imelda.
Well, if Houston Fire is doing that many water rescues, I assume that's what the USAR is doing. And also, I heard a hospital had to evacuate. Do you know about that?
I have not heard about that in particular. There's definitely been a lot of local and regional assets at work. Of course, the Texas has two task forces that are at work. Helping out there as well. I don't know that there's any, federal level assets at work from outside the state anyway. I think it's been localized and slow developing enough that they could stay ahead of it.
Well, I remember reading a story once in a book I actually contributed to on disaster stories that the hospital flooded and the folks were just moving the patients upward. So, you know, it would come up to one floor and they'd have everybody moved up to other floors. Is that something that's common or was that just that's we're here, it's what we got to do?
Well, I think it raises a whole lot of really interesting questions and challenges related to evacuation. You know, it's one of those things where if you're going to do it, you need to do it ahead of time. And the logistics behind that are monstrous, as you can imagine, taking an entire patient population from a hospital and having to move it to some other hospital, which might even be your competitor hospital. And the challenges associated with that versus deciding to wait and see how it goes and then realizing that your window of opportunity is effectively closed and now you can't evacuate the premises and all you have left to do is move up and hope that you don't run out of space there. It's a really tough position to be in from a hospital administrator standpoint. You know, you'll be chastised for jumping the gun and bailing too early if it turns out to be a Dorian that doesn't do an awful lot of damage in the area that you happen to be at. And if you didn't make that move, then you'll be chastised for not having the forethought to have taken care of that a couple of days ago when it would have been much easier to do than it is now. So the decision-making process there is fraught with lots of different masters, from doing the right thing for the patient to doing the right thing for the employees to doing the right thing financially for the hospital system and politically. And, there's just so many layers to that it really puts people in very challenging positions to try to figure out the right thing to do there.
Yeah, well, in their defense, I believe this was Katrina, and the one thing they didn't plan on was the levees breaking, and that's what caused the problem. What are your thoughts on that, Jamie?
Well, you know, I'm just looking at the storm track for Imelda, and, you know, I think one of the things that I think caught people by surprise, and I'll be curious to hear if Becky and Kyle have any input on this, was the fact that it just slowed down the way it did and stopped, you know, and just started dumping rain. I mean, if this had been like so many storms that tend to, once they make landfall and start to hit, you know, make that turn, they catch the jet stream and they pick up speed. And so they rain a lot, but they're moving fast enough that they never really leave a lot in one place. But this kind of did, you know, slowed up and dumped a lot of rain over several days and is still parked not too far from where it came ashore. Was that expected? I mean, was that something that they were able to kind of say this is going to slow down a significant amount when they first started looking at it?
Becky, you want to grab that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a tough question to answer. Did we know that there was going to be a significant amount of rainfall several days out? Yes. This is the 19th. I can remember at least the 15th, 16th, we were saying this is going to be a major flooding event. Obviously, in situations like this, where exactly that heavy rain sets up is always a bit up in the air because you don't know where those heaviest rain bands are going to park themselves. I think Imelda did strengthen just a tad bit right before landfall. So there's that interesting thing of it did get upgraded to a tropical system literally just before rainfall. And I think that's what's throwing people off a little bit here. This was always pretty well forecast. It just sort of, unfortunately, when it gets named at that last minute, people, you know, that's when they start paying attention. It's a little bit more difficult for people to pay attention to storms if they don't have a name, if that makes sense. And so because Imelda wasn't actually named until yesterday, 2 days ago, this is Thursday. I don't think people really started paying attention until maybe the last 36 to 48 hours. And obviously I don't think that we were anticipating 45 inches of rain. That's always a little bit difficult to forecast. It's not a forecast that's easy to make. I did see forecast of 10 to 20 or more inches at least 2 or 3 days ago.
Yeah, and I'm curious, Kyle, because we talk about this a lot in the, you know, the rating system and the classification systems that we use to warn people and get people's attention. But if this had come ashore and not been named a storm, it just would have been a tropical wave coming through. It still could have caused a significant amount of flooding and then rain event, and people need to pay attention to their local forecast. This is one of the reasons we say don't pay attention to, is it a tropical storm? Oh, it's just a class, you know, it's just a class one. No, we need to pay attention to the weather reports locally that can tell us what to expect. And while they may not have predicted 45 inches, they, as Becky said, were predicting 20 plus inches in some places.
Jamie, you're absolutely right. And it unfortunately goes to show sometimes how much of a short-term memory we have in forgetting some very valuable lessons. That exact scenario occurred back in 2016 across the Baton Rouge, Louisiana area. A absolutely catastrophic, widespread inland flooding event from heavy rainfall from a non-named tropical system. Because people don't pay attention, right? You have all these different factors that go into, you know, what picks up. And as Becky hinted at, right, if it doesn't have a name, well, it's very hard for that information to be marketed to people, very hard for that information to stick with them. And for an event like this, it really shows to underscore how these are really what we, I like to call those gray area storms, where it's not a hurricane. And Becky, you're right, it did reach that tropical storm status in terms of wind speed only, of course, with that rating system just before landfall. But that, as we've hinted at before on here on the podcast and said several times, the classification of what that system is, whether it's a tropical depression, tropical storm, or hurricane, is based purely on wind speed alone and does absolutely, I think, a total disservice in conveying what the actual impacts are. And so, while it didn't have the sexy adornment of hurricane in its name, we see that these are the impacts that can be caused, and we've yet to see the end of it.
Well, Becky, I think it was something I got from you on social media was one of the reasons they don't name storms too early is say that, you know, they've got the INVEST and they've got all the different levels. But say you have number 10 and then you have number 11. So logically, number 10 would be named first, but then number 11 turns out to be more serious. Can you go over that just a little bit?
I mean, naming doesn't really actually have anything to do with chronological order. It all depends on when the wind speeds in that particular storm reach criteria. So in this case, with Jerry and Imelda being named pretty close in pretty close succession, I think we thought that maybe they would be reversed or something. But really, it just depends on when the wind speeds reach that criteria, because as Kyle said, designation of category is solely based on the winds in a storm. And so it's based on the winds that the hurricane hunters measure. And in this case, they did find winds to be that of tropical storm force with Imelda shortly before landfall. And so then it was upgraded at that point. And then obviously Jerry was upgraded as well. So, I mean, it really has nothing to do with order or timing. It's all depending on when they strengthen and then when we can actually, you know, go in and measure those winds.
Well, Becky, I know this was a wild guess because you have no way of knowing, but are we likely to see another major storm this season?
I mean, given how active the tropics are now, I guess I would lean towards yes. Thankfully, Jerry is going to stay well away from the East Coast. I don't know how to answer that, to be honest. It wouldn't surprise me to see another pretty major storm impacting somewhere in the U.S., but I'm not going to, you know, say that's a guarantee. But we're still only in the middle of September, so we unfortunately still have a ways to go.
Kyle, what do you think?
Well, Sam, I think it's important to kind of keep things in context. And when we say a major storm or a major system, I think what you're really getting at is a very impactful system, not necessarily say like a major hurricane. So like a, you know, category 4 or category 5, look at the impacts already from a tropical depression, eastern Texas and western Louisiana.
Exactly.
Many hinting at and drawing comparisons to quote unquote Harvey-like impacts, and already the rainfall amounts quickly going up. And it's important to remember as well, those areas, even just 2 years on since Hurricane Harvey, Harris County, Texas, and that, many of those areas, many of those homeowners have still, you know, just finished or maybe recently finished completing renovations, rebuilding, and their personal recovery. Lots of those folks being impacted now again, the same area by flooding, inland flooding, and heavy rainfall. And so now you're putting another increased burden on that area and sending them into the response phase and now into a whole new recovery phase when some of their communities may have just been starting to come out of that recovery phase and starting to get back to their new normal.
Yeah, if there is such a thing. So, Joe, getting back to you, you had mentioned you were with a heavy rescue unit and then there are the regular USAR department. Can you go into that a little bit as far as what the USARs actually do and the different levels of expertise?
Sure. So the federal USAR system, you know, has 28 teams scattered around the country. And each of those teams has multiple different configurations. So we have a heavy team, which is really designed for major structural collapse and sort of, you know, WMD, weapons of mass destruction, and, you know, water and you name it. I mean, it's sort of the ultimate Swiss Army knife of, you know, all things that we can do. And then we have another team that or another design, I guess, that is sort of a lighter team that is doesn't haul all of the super heavy rescue stuff, meaning we can leave a couple of 18 wheelers, you know, back home. That team is about 60% the size of a heavy team. That's a light task force. You know, it's designed to be a little smaller footprint, a little more mobile, et cetera. And now we actually even have these very modular deployment units that can send out specific disciplines. So, for example, we have a modular deployment for water rescue, which is, you know, a few boats and their operators and a support system, and it is designed to supplement or augment a larger team that's in the field. So you know, for a deployment like Dorian, where it looked like we were going to have a major storm and a major storm impact in a, you know, a highly populated area, and the fact that Mickey Mouse was at risk. The response from the federal system at that level of storm moving on that level of population warrants a pretty heavy response from FEMA. So there were several heavy teams in the field. There were about an equal number of light teams in the field. And then there was an even greater number of the more modular, you know, boat communication, et cetera, kind of teams that were out there. So we were sort of strategically staged initially across Florida with the idea that some of the teams needed to be south of the potential impact site, others needed to be north, so that we were prepared to respond from either side. And then as the storm began to turn, we began to sort of do this leapfrog kind of thing up the East Coast, where teams that were in initially staged in northern Florida or were coming down the East Coast from their home bases up north were held in place in North Carolina, Virginia, et cetera, not knowing exactly where the storm might impact. So it is a very dynamic thing to do, is to have these teams in the field. It's no small issue to move, 100 people and three tractor trailers and, you know, five other box trucks and multiple, you know, smaller vehicles across the country, and to have them where they can respond. And, you know, the logistics behind that are pretty overwhelming in where are you going to put 100 people and all of those vehicles. They don't just fit in any parking lot anywhere. And, you know, we're reluctant to tie into local hotels and that kind of stuff, because we don't want to be taking up space for those that have been impacted by the storm who may well need that resource. So, you know, we have to have fairgrounds or convention centers or school gymnasiums or military bases that we ended up spending some time at while we're being staged and moved around to make certain that we are staying ahead of where the storm likely is going, and we're ready for whatever may come our way.
Yeah, we could definitely do a whole podcast on disaster logistics. People don't understand what it takes to move those people and equipment and you know, care and feeding of the teams. And oh my God. Anyway, Joe, one other thing that I was thinking about. So you've got Houston Fire out there rescuing people and the Cajun Navy, and now you've got USAR. So those are three different types of agencies trying to accomplish the same thing. How does that get coordinated?
Well, and you know what you didn't mention is sort of multiple state teams that are, I'm sure, are engaged as well as lots of mutual aid from surrounding fire departments and all kinds of stuff. So, again, back to the logistics of it all, and we from a FEMA standpoint, you know, our job is to reach out to our liaison folks that are at the state emergency operations office or a regional or even a local emergency operations center who are, you know, directly working that event, and basically say to them, we're here. This is what we can do. This is where we are. Tell us, what our mission is. You know, where do we need to go? Where do you want us, et cetera? So a lot of what happens at the EOCs, Emergency Operations Centers, is this sort of gathering of intelligence information on what resources are in the field. So, you know, Houston Fire has this many trucks and this many people, and the Cajun Navy has got, 50 boats and there's a team from, you know, Dallas, Fort Worth here, and there's a federal team here, and blah, blah, blah. And then as the needs assessment is done on the area, or as calls flow in and requests for assistance and help, you know, begin to percolate up through the system, then those resources get assigned to whatever the need is based on their capabilities, their location, their, you know, a million other issues that come into play there, trying to make certain that the right resource is put on the right job, and that there's a way to support those resources to get the job done. And, you know, that's why things like communication, et cetera, become so incredibly valuable, because those resources in the field need to, one, know what the job is, and then two, to be able to report back that the job is complete and here's what we did and found and took care of, what's the next mission? And so, you know, a lot of what we were doing for Hurricane Dorian when we're in quote unquote staging is we're waiting for the needs assessment to be done by the folks that are local there, or the folks whose job it is to go out and, you know, find out how big the impact was. And that information to flow back to an emergency operations center someplace, and for them then to say, we have a job that needs your skill set, and here it is, go for it. And so, you know, you got to be close, you got to be available, you got to be ready to respond, but at the same time, you can't totally exhaust your team by, you know, jumping up every 30 minutes and trying to move 20 yards down the road, so you're a little bit closer. It's not that easy. So, you know, there's a whole methodology around at what point do you break camp where you are and try to find another giant place to put an entire task force that can support them and have them in that area, and how long is it going to take them to get there, and can we feed and water and fuel them and all that sort of stuff while they're there, et cetera. So, you know, again, it's moving an army in many ways, and it works very much like the military does as far as their logistics and mobility are concerned.
One last question on that, Joe. The Cajun Navy aside, they pretty much become pros at this, but do well-meaning volunteers taking their own boats out, are they a hindrance or a help?
Well, I think that's a really challenging question. You know, there are individuals out there that are determined to take advantage of people in the situation. And they are always there, and they're opportunists, basically. There are a lot of really wonderful, well-meaning people that are out there trying to do some good for their neighbors and their fellow man. And sometimes their naivete and lack of experience gets them into positions that they shouldn't be in, and they ultimately result in, you know, additional work by people that know what they're doing to help rescue them. And, you know, I think it's part of the mantra that we've talked about here a long time. That's where affiliation with an entity that has some knowledge and experience in these situations really helps, to ensure that your well-meaning efforts are not are utilized to their maximum benefit and are not squandered away, and that you don't inadvertently put yourself in harm's way or ultimately get in the way of something that is happening that you didn't have situational awareness of, because you simply don't have the infrastructure to be aware of that.
And I guess knowing how to swim is probably a plus. Becky, any final weather thoughts from you?
I don't think so at this point. Just, you know, don't let your guard down yet. Hurricane season is not over. And I really want to second Kyle's point, and that it you know, it doesn't have to be a hurricane or any, you know, major storm for it to be very impactful. So just know your risk and know what your emergency plans and procedures are.
Important point that. Kyle, last words?
I think it's also just important to remember as well that even with Hurricane Imelda, as it transitions, you know, and it loses some of its energy and becomes post-tropical depression, you know, Imelda, I don't care what name you put on it, it's absolutely still deadly with the amount of rainfall that it's producing. And also to just add on and bring folks back to Joe, remind me if I'm wrong here, but if I think it was during your Harvey deployment with your team is where you almost had two team members lose their lives. So just goes to show that even our professional responders are putting themselves at great risk to come and help our communities.
Hurricane Zelda, Joe?
Yeah. So yes, Kyle, you are correct that we did have two team members that were very luckily did not lose their lives in a really nearly tragic situation. I was actually wondering about it as quickly as these named storms are coming up this year. I wondered, do the names go all the way through Z? And has there ever been a time when we've reached Hurricane Zelda or Zorro or any of that sort of stuff? Question for the weather guys.
Becky?
So I'm trying to find the exact specifics. The answer is yes. So we have obviously all the names through the alphabet. And then after, if we've gone through all of those, I think they then start on Greek names. Kyle, do you have... I'm just there on the tip of my tongue.
Kyle?
So, yeah, Becky, you're totally right. We do have, they go A through Z, and that's a list that's curated by the World Meteorological Organization, actually are the ones who give these names to these, you know, these named storms, these tropical systems, and they do go A through Z, and, you know, I don't have a computer in front of me. I'm actually on the road, so I can't recall a time where we may have gone on the way through Z. I think I hear Becky doing some research there in the background.
Since the name list has been started in the Atlantic in 1950, the furthest they've gone down the list has been Tropical Storm Zeta in 2005. So I believe that's well past. That's actually not the Z name. That's into the Greek
names at that point. Holy smokes, really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's a bad season right there.
That's a very bad season.
Because you're right. That's way down the Greek alphabet, too. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Okay.
No more complaining. Jamie's waiting for the storm named after his sister-in-law, so I'm not going to touch that. Okay, Jamie, final thoughts? And
we always look in our family. It's one of the things we do every year for fun in the springtime is look and see whose name comes up that year's hurricane list. So this year, it's my sister-in-law's name, Melissa, is popped up. So we're waiting for, I think, two more storms for Melissa to show up on the radar, or three more storms. This has been an interesting season already. And as both Kyle and Becky noted, it's not over yet. We have just crested the busiest time of the hurricane season. We have until November to go yet, folks. So let's not let our guards down and make sure we're prepared. I think, you know, as Imelda has shown and our statistics continually show, most of our rescues and loss of life and all that stuff happens because of flooding and storm surge. So inland flooding and storm surge, that's the water component. And it has nothing to do with the classification of the storm, which is a wind component. So we need to be aware of that and keep that in mind. And that goes with training, and that comes along with knowing how to understand what to expect, to be prepared for your area, and having good training resources takes care of that, and at least in part. And I know, Joe, you guys bring your specific training resources to bear for whatever people are expecting. You know, if you know, you go into an area that's had a lot of flooding recently, you you cater your stuff to help them deal with what they expect to deal with in those situations. And Paragon's really good at that. So, you know, thank you again for collaborating with us on this podcast. And is there a place or a way that you'd like people to reach out to you so you can help them understand what you can do for them?
Absolutely. Our motto is certainly Semper Gumby, so always be flexible because you never know what you're going to face. But we would be more than happy to talk with folks, and they can find us on the web at Paragon Medical Education Group or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group, and always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
And, you know, it occurs to me, Joe, that there is an entire generation of responders that are coming into the ranks right now that have no idea what we mean when we say Semper Gumby, do they?
That's the truth. Sad as it may be, but that's true.
Anyway, thanks again, Joe, for all your support. We appreciate it. Becky, where can folks find you if they want to follow? I know Sam alluded to the fact that you share a lot of amazing weather-related stuff, photographs and retweets and information throughout the course of the week, and they can follow you. So how can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Find me on Twitter, WX_Beck. So you can search Becky D. Podwin. I'm the only one. And yeah, really this week I've just been retweeting a lot of great weather information that's been coming mostly out of Texas, but some other good weather tidbits here and there with the other tropical information going on. And of course, always happy to answer any questions in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, and I really enjoy the conversations we have over there.
Awesome. How about you, Kyle?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me in all the social media places under the handle WXKyleNelson. So feel free to follow along with me on Twitter and Instagram on my latest adventures and for weather information, or connect with me on LinkedIn to continue the conversation.
And thank you for joining us from the road. Please be safe in your travels, and we'll catch up with you again soon, I'm sure. We always love to know what you're up to and where you're headed. Sam, how about you?
Well, you can follow me following Becky and Kyle. I'm fascinated by all this weather stuff that they're coming up with. But otherwise, you can find me under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in the usual social media places, certainly in the Disaster Podcast the Disaster Podcast Facebook group and disasterpodcast.com. Jamie, what about you?
As we've said just about every week here, Podmedic is the best way to find me on social media. So definitely find me there, friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me. And, you know, disasterpodcast.com. If you head over there and check out the episode page right there below the player, you can actually subscribe to the show. So if you have your favorite mobile device or your favorite mobile app platform for podcast, you can search for us there, or you can just click the link in the actual episode page for any of these episodes, and it'll take you right to the directions on how to subscribe quick and easy. And some of them, it's just click and it automatically subscribes you. So please do that. That way you won't miss any of our episodes. You know, Sam, we have always have lots of plans for what we're going to talk about each week. And like you said earlier, hurricane season keeps us busy. And this is definitely an indication of that.
Yeah, as well, we have guests who are scheduled, and then another storm comes along, and we have to reschedule. So that's a lot of fun. But, hey, we got some really good people coming up. And just to remind you guys, we're actually leaning into year number 7. Can you believe that, as the year winds down? So I'm pretty proud of that. I think the fact that people are still listening after all this time and we're picking up new listeners, I think that's pretty awesome.
Speaking of new listeners, I have to give a shout out to an Australian listener who found me. He actually follows me as an author and found out I did this podcast and loves listening to stuff about first responders. He's a retired police officer. So he likes this kind of stuff. And so hey to Jason. Hopefully he heard that. And, you know, if you want to shout out and reach out to us, join the Facebook community. Join the conversation, as we always say.
Well, hi, Jason. And goodbye, folks. We're off to see what the next storm brings. But, Jamie, this is a good example of disaster weather is not our everyday weather.